So I'm Evan Mogren. I'm a lawyer who works on the production of freedom, mostly with the makers and distributors of free software, and mostly at the moment for one client, whom you know. Because Richard was kind enough to go through the state of substantive affairs in the drafting of GPL3, I want to take time this afternoon before answering your questions to give some context for the effort that he describes in detail. First, I think I owe you, as citizens of the Free Republic, some more precise information about the process and its state at the present moment. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about the larger aspects of our life in the Free Republic into which GPL3 fits. But the first thing I think I ought to do is to give you some news. Mr. Gates has surrendered. And before we get all back to fighting again among ourselves, we ought at least to recognize the meaning of that step. In the United States, when a major corporate executive resigns or retires, there is a mandatory process of talking calm to the markets. You don't resign on less than 2 years' notice so as to give the feeling of orderly transition and complete control over circumstances. If, for example, the chief executive officer of the Enron Corporation resigns suddenly on no notice, then that's a sign that immense trouble is immediately ahead, as in that case bankruptcy was by 6 weeks. So for Mr. Gates to have announced that he is retiring from active service to Microsoft on 2 years' notice is the minimum length of time that could have been chosen without sending the signal Microsoft is in acute short-term trouble. It isn't, my God, everything is great, he's giving 2 years' notice. It's, that's the least that could have been done. However, this particular retirement was announced to occur approximately 5 months before the most crucial product release in 10 years. So anything that leads you to believe that this is normal, ordinary, Mr. Gates promised Mr. Allen and Mr. Ballmer that he would stay at Microsoft until at least 50, which he now is, all of that talk is irrelevant. Mr. Gates last week announced his retirement on the shortest possible timeline that wouldn't spook the markets, a resignation announced 6 months before the shipment of the most important product in 10 years. I am characterizing that fairly when I characterize it as personal surrender. Even better, Mr. Gates has surrendered and is leaving the company to Mr. Ballmer. Better news for us could not have been imagined. So, that's where they are. Where are we? We are on schedule with the most important work we have done in 15 years. Anybody who thinks that Mr. Stallman's retirement is about to be announced wasn't here this morning. He's 54. Mr. Gates is 50. Mr. Gates has quit and left the field to younger men like Mr. Stallman. So here we are, in the middle of a GPL3 process, which, as to timing at any rate, seems to be going on at the right moment. As you all know, we released a first discussion draft in January at MIT. We said, it's a discussion draft. We're listening carefully to what people may want to say about it. And we convened a large and admittedly somewhat complicated process for listening to what people had to say. The first thing that turned out to be on everybody's mind was that GPL version 2 was perfect. I know that it was perfect because everything we wanted to change, they told us we shouldn't change at all. And the implication, therefore, was we had been living with an absolutely perfect license, every single change in which was a bad idea. I wasn't absolutely surprised about this. Human beings have a certain resistance to change. And I wasn't surprised that everything we proposed changing turned out they really loved in the old version. But it is good to know, at any rate, that GPL2 is perfect. So if anything goes wrong and we don't do GPL3, the world will still have a perfect license with which to work. I actually think, if I might dare to say so, after 15 years of working with it carefully, that GPL2 can be improved, and we are improving. But it's nice to know that the world at large had come to regard it with such fondness before we started changing it. Within a couple of weeks after our announcement of the draft and the process for discussing it, I began to hear rumors that we weren't really going to listen to anybody. Apparently, we had gone to enormous amounts of work to create a worldwide process for listening to everybody solely as a sham. Actually, I heard Mr. Stallman was going to make all the decisions all by himself. Every once in a while, I even heard people saying that I was going to make decisions by myself, which, if they knew Mr. Stallman, they wouldn't say. So, in any event, for a little while there, it looked, I suppose, to some people as though this whole grand effort to get everybody else's advice and wisdom involved was somehow just a game we were playing, which is, from my point of view, too bad that it's not true. If this were a game we were playing about taking everybody's opinion seriously, I could get a lot more sleep. But unfortunately, it's not that way. We actually set out to listen to everybody as carefully as we could in a context in which each kind of commentator would feel comfortable making his and her kinds of comments and commenting on behalf of their organizations. And we've been listening extremely hard for 4.5 months, and there's a great deal that we have learned in the course of that time. I want to talk just a little bit then about that process, which the world at large has seen, but only one side of. We made discussion committees by asking those people who joined us in Cambridge for the launch to join into committees organized around types of social role in the process. Vendors of commercial versions of free software or of hardware that works with free software. Leadership of free software projects that do use GPL, that don't use GPL. Lawyers on behalf of large users. Corporate officials working on behalf of corporations that are large users, public servants who are interested in public sector adoption, individual hackers with substantial street cred whose views might be influential in helping other people to consider the license either as one to use or as one to improve, and so on. Those committees meet in different ways. One committee consisting entirely of hackers prefers to work almost exclusively by IRC. One group consisting very largely of persons employed by major vendors tends to use large conference calls. Parties use the forms of interaction which are comfortable and convenient for them, and we attempt to provide an environment in which everybody's comments can be heard and thought about with a sense of equality among participants. As Richard said, we created a little web services code that didn't exist before. We needed an application for allowing a very large number of people to attach comments to a single document and for the world at large to be able to see in an intuitive way, reading the text, where the comments concentrated and what level of intensity and how to click through there to get to other people's comments quickly on particular areas of interest or concern. I actually think that software did a pretty good job. It reduced the volume of comments somewhat, at the cost of, or at the benefit of, greatly increased specificity in comments. Because the STET system made people go and highlight an area of text and say, this is what I'm talking about and this is what I have to say, the quality of comments was very high. And the number was rendered more manageable because people didn't file essentially comment spam saying I hate the whole thing or I love the whole thing, or they actually went and found a place where they had something to say and said it. We had about 1,000 non-trivial comments from third parties not involved in the discussion process in any way, just people who used the system to register commentary of importance to them. In that 1,000, every one of which was reviewed by somebody working on the process with me, with Richard, with David Turner, with Richard Fontana. In that process of looking at every single one of those comments, I will say that at least one, maybe two or three really important issues were seen for the first time by somebody unaffiliated with our process in formal terms who simply had a damn good point to make which needed to be taken into account. Let me give you one example of an important issue unearthed in the public comment process, which will have an effect on the second discussion draft of the license. As you all know, since the beginning of the license, it has concentrated a great deal of attention on distribution as the moment at which obligations attached to your role in the free community. The assumption has always been that distribution is a one-way activity. Somebody distributes and a user receives. If binaries are being distributed in particular, the binary distributor has an obligation to make source code available to a receiving user. All of this made a great deal of sense in 1991, and it probably still makes a great deal of sense in 2006, but consider the situation of an ISO image of a CD containing binaries of free software material under GPL being distributed among persons by BitTorrent. If you think about that scenario for just a moment, you will see that in the torrent are a bunch of people, quote, distributing binaries, close quote, who don't think of themselves as distributors, who think of themselves as users receiving the binary, who have no source code, and who haven't even got all the binary yet. So that even if source code will later be part of the same torrent, they're not guaranteed to have it, and they can't pass it along. Under GPL2, an unaffiliated commentator said to us, this would be infringing activity. Why don't you do something about that in GPL3? We looked at it and we said, you know, you're right. That's a major problem. That is to say, it's not all that hard to fix, but it's a major problem not to have seen it. We're glad you brought it up. And we will make a few very narrow changes in the second discussion draft of GPL3 to allow for the fact that peer-to-peer models of distribution may involve ancillary transmission by people who would traditionally have been thought of as receivers and who shouldn't have any obligations under the license because they're not actually engaged in the sense we used to mean in distribution. That's an example of an important technical issue in the changing use and context of the license raised by somebody from outside the process. And as I say, there are probably two or three more of equivalently important scope that I could point to. That kind of commentary is worth its weight in gold. It is because of that kind of commentary from unaffiliated individuals that the entire process is worth maintaining, cost what it will to maintain it, to read its output, to think about every word it says. That's exactly what we were hoping for. That's exactly what we're getting. I have enormous respect for those people around the world who have decided to take the time and trouble to make comments on this license. They're doing a bang-up job. As somebody who has to think about this all day, every day right now, I am immensely pleased that smart people would be willing voluntarily to take some time on it. And the quality of what we have gotten in every way demonstrates the power of the multiplied hive mind. We are getting great work out of people. This is true of the committees a fortiori. Committee members have spent dozens of hours, in some cases hundreds of hours, working on this license. They have spent a lot of time communicating. They have spent a lot of time refining ideas. They have spent a lot of time coming up with improvements or suggestions or possible changes in language. They have been willing to do what in intercorporate negotiations is often hard to do. They have come out and said what they wanted and said what they needed clearly and candidly. And I'm very grateful to them for doing that. It has made it possible for us to understand what it would take to provide a license whose users, commercial as well as non-commercial, would feel themselves protected in their rights. And that's a powerful and important task that we set to perform and that we could not perform without all the effort and time and thinking that has gone into it on other people's parts. I believe that the first several months of discussion of the first discussion draft have been beneficial to the quality of the draft in every way. As you will see when it is released, there are few articles that have not been substantially rewritten. I am still puzzled by people's belief that we weren't going to listen. I know that if I could release right this minute by throwing up on the screen a strikeout and bold copy of the new draft showing everything removed and everything inserted, that it would be harder for people to take seriously this claim that we weren't listening. They would see their language coming out and language going in that they would recognize as directly responsive to public comment and to suggestion. In a few weeks, that's what people will see. And I believe that that will allow us to enter the second discussion period with much more confidence on the world's part that the work that they are doing to help us improve the license is being gratefully and thoughtfully received. In the process of revising the license second discussion draft, we have done more work on what I think of as the fundamental challenge in internationalization. A question was asked this morning about translation. And translation is unquestionably one possible way of internationalizing the license. But translation is, in my judgment, at best, a second best way of internationalizing the license, and for the reasons that Richard offered this morning, a somewhat dangerous way. The best way of internationalizing the license, in my judgment, is to look as firmly as possible to the work done more than 110 years ago in the making of the Berne Convention. An attempt to harmonize global copyright law in the world is now more than 110 years old. The United States was late to come to Berne as a full participant in the harmonizing of copyright law. That's the good part of the thing called the Digital Millennium Copyrights Act. There is a good part, trust me. Not much, but a little. And given that we are all now existing in a Berne universe, the right way of internationalizing is to come as close to Berne Convention mechanisms as possible. In order to do that, the one step really needed is to get out of the license dependence on any single legal system's vocabulary or unique conceptions. And so our effort has been to genericize the way the license does its work. I'll give you an example which came up in a conversation I had with Carlo Piana over lunch. One defect in the license, as seen in some countries of the world under GPL2, was that GPL2 stated that it was a perpetual license. German-speaking lawyers, for example, working in Germany, and that's only one example, said, you know, our legal system really doesn't like that much. In fact, in order to be valid, licenses need to state a term. Well, all right, we said. We understand that there are some legal systems around the world in which stating a term may be necessary or desirable in order to make a good license. There are also legal systems around the world. We work in one in the United States where making licenses perpetual is the right idea, because having non-exclusive licenses good only for a term is an invitation to trouble. One way you could go at this is to translate the license so that it says one thing in German and another thing in English. But as Mr. Stallman pointed out this morning, that's exactly the danger. Otherwise, you appear to be put to a bad choice. Choose one or choose the other, and somebody will be unhappy with you. So the goal in modifying the license is to do neither and still achieve the result needed by both. As you notice, the first discussion draft said GPL now is a license for a term, and the term is the length of copyright on the underlying program. Perpetual so far as the copyright is, and no more perpetual than that, and can be stated as a fixed term reducible to a number at any given moment. Accordingly, I hope and believe, based on the legal advice we've taken from lawyers around the world who are helping us with this matter, we have succeeded in finessing a problem where we might have been thought to face a choice between something that will work in System 1 and something that will work in System 2, but not both. The second discussion draft of the license goes still further in that path. As Richard mentioned this morning, we have once again attempted to take vocabulary and consolidate it so that there is a set of terms unique to GPL, all of which can be defined by relation to underlying copyright law in each individual copyright system. So propagation is doing anything with a program that requires local permission under copyright law, except running it or privately modifying it. Conveying it is propagating the program in a way that that makes it possible for others to make or receive copies. By using language which is not U.S. copyright language or anybody else's copyright language, but by stating only the relationship between license terms of art and states of fact in the world, we think we can get rid of a large number of problems arising out of national law. I will say, therefore, the second discussion draft of GPL3 will not have any longer any dependency on the American copyright law idea of a derivative work. Accordingly, we will be able to avoid another 15 years of complaining from lawyers who quite justifiably thought the reliance on a U.S.-centric view of the derivative work was a major source of uncertainty and uneasiness. They may think that what we have done instead is not a perfect improvement, but I feel certain that there will at least be the recognition that it's a useful development. Internationalization of the license, as I said at the beginning in Cambridge, goes along with the other major structural change that we wanted to make, which Richard described this morning, as we described it in January, as enhanced compatibility. I want to go back over that ground a little bit for you in order to put the context a little more deeply around it. After Richard's discussion of enhanced compatibility this morning, a question was asked in the question period, what about license proliferation? Our answer to license proliferation, I think, I want to expand a little bit on Richard's remarks, is very straightforward now. Use GPL. Add the permissions that you need. If the restrictions you would have put in a different license are restrictions compatible with GPL under Section 7, you need not make any new license. If you don't like copyleft, we can do nothing for you. But if you don't like copyleft, then you should recognize license proliferation as the necessary consequence of the non-copyleft licensing you prefer to do. In other words, ask yourselves, why has there been license proliferation? There has not been proliferation of copyleft licenses. Or rather, there has been very limited proliferation of copyleft licenses. There are two or three copyleft licenses in the world with any significant mindshare. Permissive licenses have multiplied all out of keeping. But it is precisely because permissive licensing has as a necessary consequence the proliferation of licenses that we are where we are. Parties who wanted to license in non-proliferating ways had too few choices when there were a small number of copyleft licenses and they all worked in pretty much one way only. GPL's new Section 7, the enhanced compatibility provision, will allow copyleft licensing to be used more flexibly while still striking the balance in the direction of commercial usability for businesses and clarity for individual developers who want to know what license to apply to their code. I think it makes an enormous contribution if people care to use it in that way. That's up to everybody else. We will have laid down an infrastructure for license interoperation, which we believe, if used fully, will have a very substantial effect in reducing proliferation over the next few years. Some comment was made this morning about the LGPL as a Section 7 additional permission on top of GPL. I would have left that subject to be disclosed when we show you the drafts in a couple of weeks. But as the subject has come up, let me just say one little thing about it. That move does not change the behavior of LGPL at all, as Richard told you this morning. We adopted a no functional change constraint in the reshaping of the license. What it does is to allow LGPL to serve as a good example of the additional permissions structure for GPL and how powerful it is. By expressing LGPL as just an additional permission on top of GPL, we simplify our licensing landscape drastically. It's like for physics getting rid of a force, right? We just unified electroweak, okay? The grand unified field theory still escapes us until the document licenses, too, are just additional permissions on top of GPL, and I don't know how we'll ever get there. That's gravity. It's really hard. But the physics has gotten simpler, and I think that alone is valuable. The other thing is that the new LGPL expressed as permission will show people how to use permissions to make quite sophisticated licenses very simply. And we think that also is all to the good because such licenses do not proliferate. They reconvert to GPL at the instance of modifiers, which is a valuable and useful property to have. That's all I want to say about the technical material in the license, except to talk about issues. As we said at the outset, there are two or three dominant issues that remain to be talked out in order to get to a consensus about the license. One issue, or one group of issues, has to do with the handling of patent rights. The other issue has to do with the control over software in the interest of entertainment security. I want to talk very briefly about both of those because Richard talked at length and I don't want to redo anything he said. So I'm going to try to add only, and in questions you'll take up what you think I've been too light on. With respect to patents, the issue has changed radically in the last couple of years. GPL version 2 is a license that says, there's a terrible patent problem. If you don't do something about it, all hell is going to break loose sooner or later. Sooner or later has come and gone, and everybody knows that all hell has broken loose. The fundamental question now for everybody is how to invent around the patent system through the license so as to achieve optimal goals for several different classes of parties. Parties who have large patent portfolios and want to contribute to the free software world and GPL in particular. Parties who are afraid of other people's patents because they make revenues that could be the source of claims for royalties. And parties who want to develop software and are afraid of patents, not because they have commercially significant revenue streams, but because they are afraid of the chilling effect of announcements of patents or patent licenses or patent lawsuits as a way of politically inhibiting people from making desirable free software. Those are quite distinct groups. Some parties, that is, parties with large patent portfolios also having significant revenue streams, appear more than once in the interest group analysis of the patent problems. Each of those major industrial parties with large patent portfolios has well-developed patent policies of its own and well-developed positions in negotiations with other parties in the industry concerning its patent portfolios. We, although we have a certain sophistication in those conversations, having sat in them for years, have no patents and no clout in that world, usually. Right now, we have some clout because we make a license people need. But we cannot overuse that clout. We must make a license that people need as much as they need the one we are changing. The discussion about patents has been very complicated, very thick, sometimes rather heated, though those parties who have tried to apply fire to the soles of my feet have been kind enough to do it privately instead of publicly, still there has been a great deal of attempted torture. I have responded as gently as I possibly could, but sometimes I have said harsh words back, too, for which I am now publicly stating that I don't regret it at all. Bargaining is bargaining. We will be done soon. I believe that great progress has been made among the patent holders in understanding what they need collectively as well as individually, and what represents good outcomes from the Free Software Foundation position in this matter. We have considered a number of changes to the statements contained in the first discussion draft about patents. We have listened exceedingly carefully to everybody who had anything to say on that subject, whether they were patent holders or not, and we think we have proposals to make in the near future that will be very helpful in resolving these issues. Once those issues are resolved, we need movement on other questions too. Which brings us to the subject of Richard's major address this morning, the problem of digital restrictions over code. People have tended to think of this as though Richard was trying to cram down their throat a replacement word for what they were doing. Companies that make entertainment content think they have digital rights and that they should be allowed to manage their digital rights. I have no stake in that one way or another. As a private citizen, I have real strong feelings about that. But my role right now is to be a lawyer for the free software movement. And as a lawyer for the free software movement, I have nothing to do with music and nothing to do with movies. I don't represent the Free Music Foundation. I don't represent the Free Movie Foundation. I represent people who care about making free software. And for them, Mr. Stallman is quite right, what are digital rights management issues to entertainment companies are simply restrictions management to us. Because what is restricted is the right to make our software the way we make our software. That restriction is said to follow from somebody's use of his own rights over his own copyrighted works, music and movies, but that means nothing to us. Not because we think there shouldn't be copyright on music or movies, or because we think sharing should be free, or whatever it is. That's all irrelevant. You will hear a lot of talk about DRM in which it is suggested that we are somehow trying to use a software license to address non-software issues. Nothing could be further from the truth. We are addressing a software issue. Is GPL software being distributed in a way which would be illegal if the license were being evaded? And which is solely regarded as legal because the license evasion is technically implemented. If I send you a computer containing software under GPL, let's say I make a digital video recorder, let's say I call it TiVo, and I sell it to you and I say there's GPL software in here, here's the source code. The only thing is, if you modify this software inside my box, I will cut your service off, That would be a straightforward violation of GPL. You would be adding a condition to the license, and you couldn't do it. Now, why is such a big deal that everybody should jump up and down and yell and scream and carry on if we say, oh, and by the way, what you're not allowed to do by illegally modifying the license, you're not allowed to do by modifying the hardware so that the license can be evaded safely. It's a straightforward proposition. You can't do it this way, and you can't do it that way either. Why are you trying to evade the license? Well, we're very concerned about copyright on music and movies. Don't give me that. That's like any other reason for evading a license. Well, we're very interested in making money, Mr. Stallman, and if we break your license, we could make more money. Sorry, that's not a reason. So what we are talking about is not something about why we're mad at Hollywood or why we're mad at the music factories. That's another discussion. We are saying that the license should prohibit technical means of evasion of its rules with the same clarity that it prohibits legal evasion of its rules. That's all. On that subject, we do not believe that there is a lot of room for principled argument going the other way. But such room as there is, we're open to listening to. Richard emphasized today that if this attempt to inhibit evasion of the license came in the form of a refusal to permit use, it would be wrong to do. Some of the language we published in January led people to conclude we were imposing use restrictions in order to deal with a mode of evasion of the license by people seeking security for entertainment. To the extent that that language caused people to feel that that's what we were doing, it was plainly badly chosen language, and it will be replaced in GPL-3, second discussion draft. Richard also said this morning that we have been working against the background of a moving target in Europe, as European domestic implementations of EUCD threw up new legal restrictions that we might have to confront and deal with. At the present moment, we believe that the next draft will contain language successfully repelling the force of both the US DMCA and the EUCD without employing use restrictions or other inappropriate technology within the context of the license. We are continuing to work with lawyers around the world to see to it that the final draft will also act to get in the way of anti-circumvention law written elsewhere in the world using other legal concepts. The goal is to make it possible for people who get GPL software to exercise the rights promised to them by the license. Sure, I apologize. I also apologize for using English. I appreciate that that may be difficult for some people. To go back over that point, I wanted to say that we will use as best we can other legal advice we have taken to ensure that the final version of the license works against other anti-circumvention law around the world, not merely EUCD and US DMCA statutes, but other legal regulations elsewhere in the world as well. I want to wrap up and take questions for the rest of the time. I suspect there are a lot of questions. Let me just say something, because for me, this is the halfway point in a long process. Let me say something about what will happen when it's over. You may be less concerned about that than I am. Halfway through this process, I am very eager to think about the day when it will be over. When it will be over, I believe probably sometime next January, we will have made, by international collaboration, the rules that govern a system of intellectual creativity also the rules that govern a multi-billion dollar industry, also the constitution of a social and political movement called the Free Software Movement. We will have adjusted the language of all three documents inside one piece of paper. The rules that allow individuals and students and classes and schools around the world to experiment freely with all forms of computer knowledge. The rules which allow multi-billion dollar businesses to operate in stable and unified ways at a time when the leading alternate model of how to make and distribute software is visibly bankrupt and incapable of performing. And we will have made clear what the constitution of the free software movement is for the next little while by stating what its goals are and how it proposes to achieve them. We will all have done all these things. Tens of thousands of people around the world will have collaborated to do those three things this year. The largest, most deeply funded monopoly in the history of the world will have lost its CEO, fired a bunch of its subordinate executives, and produced, instead of the best release in 10 years, a total commercial and technical failure. Proprietary software will have visibly collapsed, cut off at the knees by its own inefficiency. We, you and I and everybody else doing this, will have succeeded in negotiating the rules of the industry for the next decade by open collaboration. At the end of that process, politics and government and society and economics will notice that discrepancy. They will notice that discrepancy because the sound of the failure of Microsoft will be much quieter than you think. The sound of the failure of Microsoft will concentrate a lot of other people's attention because Microsoft won't be speaking so loudly anymore. On the contrary, people will be saying to themselves, they used to have $1 billion a month in profit. And they used to spend that $1 billion a month making propaganda about how their way was the only right way. Funny how they don't have that profit anymore. Funny how they can't spend all that dough on propaganda anymore. Funny how much simpler it seems now when they're not yammering so loudly. By God, now we can hear ourselves think. And in the middle of this quiet, we notice that theirs was a bad way of doing business. That's where we're going to be when this is over. We're going to have renewed our fundamental infrastructure and made it much stronger and much more flexible. The world's leading alternative approach will have died on the field of battle chosen by itself, having failed to make its own products well enough to convince the users it had already trapped to use them. That's going to be quite a shocking comparison to those who didn't know what we were up to as clearly as we did. That's all I have to say. Let me take your questions. Thanks very much.
To explain further about the difference between added restrictions and added permissions, which at least to me has been a bit unclear in the explanation of Mr. Stallman and yours, it was a bit cursory, especially as it amounts to patents. Added permissions, as you can use our patents in our portfolio, and added restrictions, as you can't use or disseminate, is the word, our software if you initiate a lawsuit. And the second question is, if you've talked to people like the Debian project, who are seemingly even stricter than the Free Software Foundation in some of the requisites for what they call freedom in licenses. It's a bit of a long question with the three parts, I realize.
Yeah, they're actually quite different, so let me try and take them as different questions. I'll speak to them differently as quickly as I can. First, I thought that one of the disadvantages of the way Section 7 was released in the first discussion draft was that it attempted to treat permissions and requirements together in one unified set of drafting. I had an alternate drafting proposal which treated permissions as one sub-subject and requirements as another. And in the second discussion draft, we adopt that drafting instead. The consequence is to make the differences among permissions and requirements easier to understand and to follow. Rather than talk my way through language that we'll have out on the street in a little bit, let me just put it in the narrowest way. Permissions are an essentially open set. You can permit pretty much anything you want in addition to GPL, but permissions are removed. Additional requirements must be one of a specific set of possible additional requirements. The set is closed, not open. Those requirements are not removable from the code which bears those requirements. Instead, you have to point each recipient of the code clearly to which additional requirements apply to which portions of the code. So if you adopt something out of an Apache licensed program, there is a patent retaliation clause in the Apache license. Therefore, you have some code in your GPL program which has a patent retaliation provision applying to it, and you have to indicate clearly to the user what code that is. That's the nature of the difference between permissions and requirements. You asked specifically about the use of the additional permission section to deal with patents. We don't rely upon the additional permission section to deal with patent rights. Whatever is going to be said about how patent rights are allocated between people making, people distributing, and people using the code will be set in the base GPL in Section 11. And how it is set will be carefully determined after discussion with all those people in the world who care about that. But there we are looking for a unique consensus solution. With respect to permissions, grants of patent allocations, non-assertion of patents, whatever it is that is the technical material, the way you know that you get what you need to practice the freedoms in the license will not be as a result of additional terms, that will be in the base terms. Patent retaliation clauses, however, go in that category of additional requirements sometimes permitted. Okay? And there the principle was stated in the first discussion draft of the license. Patent retaliation clauses are okay if they are fully defensive in character, if their purpose is solely to repel patent lawsuits and not to take other kinds of advantages using patents. The GPL will not contain any such clause. It will merely say it's compatible with licenses containing such a clause. So, to pick up your last question, there will be no issue with them. If a license out there in the world is also a free license under the Debian Free Software Guidelines, then that license, to the extent GPL permits, may be compatible with GPL. But the freedom or unfreedom of that license can be judged by looking at that license standing alone under DFSG. No license becomes GPL compatible, which isn't also capable of being compatible with the Debian Free Software Guidelines. And we won't be saying license X is compatible with GPL. We'll be saying, here's a term. GPL can use that term. If GPL accepts code under that term stays on that code, not under GPL, but under the other requirements set applicable to that code. And use all the code under GPL. If you take that piece out, remember to pass it along with the patent retaliation clause. That's all.
Thank you.
Do you expect to see the compliance with the software?
Well,
and they did it all for them.
I haven't any reason to suspect that there will be an incompatibility. I haven't any reason to believe that there is a chance of an incompatibility. It hasn't been my primary concern because it hasn't seemed to me to be even the beginning of an issue. If it were suggested somewhere along the way by our own evaluation or by somebody else's that there was a real problem with the Debian Free Software Guidelines, we would address it.
I have another question concerning the DRM clause. There is one wording that says that covered software cannot be an effective measure against in the sense of the DCMA. And do you expect this clause to be effective?
I expect that U.S. courts will be instructed on the intention of the licensor to reject the features of DMCA as it applies to GPL software. I expect the United States courts to listen closely to statements of the licensor's intent, because under U.S. copyright law, it is the licensor's intent which normatively determines the content of the license. That language was not meant to deal with EUCD arrangements, which are different. We will employ a different strategy for dealing with the EUCD, which is not present in discussion draft one, and which will see its first public exposure in discussion draft two, at which point we will then begin discussing with European lawyers, businesses, and parties what they think of that proposal.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry?
Excuse me.
Yeah, the question was asked offline whether I would now disclose what that's going to be. I have a 95% certainty that I know what the language is, but might I point out that there are two countries presently implementing EUCD right under our noses, and I reserve the right to make further changes in light of those legal changes if I need to in the next several weeks. The reason for not pre-disclosing things is that I have an obligation of professional caution. And my client, as you know, has a very deep belief in the importance of avoiding mistakes that could be permanently harmful to freedom. If this were the right day to disclose those terms, we'd disclose those terms today.
On the DRM front, is the invasion of privacy wording one of the one wording that's going to be removed from this draft?
Yes, I expect that language to be gone. I have said that in public on several occasions. I thought myself, as one lawyer, that there was a useful role to play in the license for principles that would have given private copyright holders around the world a legal weapon with which to deal with spyware problems. I think those problems are terribly severe. I expect most governments to get it wrong and keep it wrong because their incentives are misaligned. The victims of spyware are individual citizens. The beneficiaries of spyware are wealthy public and private parties with enormous benefits to gain from the continuance of low security. As Microsoft fails, and the primary provider of low network security around the world begins to fail, the parties which have benefited from 10 years of low network security, and boy have they benefited, will begin to look for other ways to ensure low network security. The monopoly was an extraordinarily good way to achieve low network security because the only party who had to take the blame was a party to whom there was no alternative and which was perfectly happy to have its non-existent reputation for integrity blackened still further. Once that is no longer true, the problem of how to achieve high network security, given many commercial parties' desire for weak network security, will grow more intense. I thought it was desirable to afford individual developers the opportunity as private attorneys general around the world to use copyright law to inhibit bad practices built into their code by subsequent modifiers. I now conclude that that's a provision for which, by and large, the community does not see it that way, and it is not hard to remove it given the absence of people's interest in it. Later, I believe, they will wish we had done that, probably in the same intensity that they would wish that we had solved the patent problem more coercively in 1991, and may very well be glad that we have solved their DRM problems for them to the extent that we are going to solve them this year. But we will leave that problem to be dealt with by the future, because it is clear that the readers of the license in the present don't see its value and do see significant drawbacks. So I believe that it will come.
Will we be able to use the same methods used to make the LGPL to make new GPLs compatible with currently incompatible licenses like the MPL, the Mozilla Public License, or the EPL?
You can always use an additional permission to combine GPL code with any other license that you want. So in that sense, yes, you can use additional permissions to make trivial compatibility between GPL and other licenses. Please remember that permissions are removable. Downstream from you, parties may decide to remove your trivial compatibility provision, thus returning the code under the license to a pure GPL state. Remember that existing LGPL contains a provision that says all code licensed under LGPL can always be relicensed under GPL. So in turning LGPL into an additional permission, we are not changing any behavior by making it a removable permission on top of GPL. If you used a similar approach to make compatibility with another license and admitted the removability, you would be fine.
How are you thinking about changing something in the title of the session? I think it's 9, not a contract, because that's a bit incompatible with the laws in some place, like in Brazil. I'm from Brazil.
I firmly disagree with that position, but nonetheless, we will do something to meet its needs. I ultimately regard this belief as narrow-minded and foolish. It belongs to half a dozen law professors around the world, each of whom should check his cards again, and it's all he. They are people with gray hair and old minds. They're not very old minds, because if in each of their legal systems they went to their old legal dictionaries and looked at what the word license means, or if they got real Roman about it and went and looked in the Institutes of Justinian to find out what license means, they would discover that a license is a unilateral permission, not an obligation. And so what happens is that these minds that say this thing, they're stuck in a little space, 1,000 years after Justinian and before the Second World War. Nonetheless, there's a view, okay? And so that view, which has been hotly repeated, deserves to be regarded with respect, though I haven't given it any respect in my personal comments, because I'm entitled to a personal opinion. As a working drafting lawyer, I expect that Section 9 will bear, when it is released, a title something like Acceptance Not Required to Receive and Run Copies, which is a statement of fact, accurate and clear, and which reduces the reliance upon a legal characterization, increasing reliance on a factual consideration, which is in general the course we have taken with respect to denationalizing the license. So much as I believe, as one working lawyer, that this is a foolish legal position, I recognize that it is a straightforward request that can be served and that should be dealt with, and we will deal with it.
two questions. First, do you have anything to say about the so-called ASP loophole or web loophole? Because in the morning, Richard said he thought of the possibility to adapt some clauses from Affero GPL to fix this problem, but it may be too drastic for GPL version 3. But I think this loophole can be very dangerous if our friend Microsoft will be gone, but we might have the next enemy because now we have so-called Web 2.0 companies, which is business model is basically built on web service. And second, would you answer this question first?
Knowing as I do that you may very well wind up not getting your second question in, but that's all right. Look, here's the situation as I think we now see it. There are two ethical points of view about what should happen when you take somebody else's code, which they wrote to interact with users over a network, modify it yourself, and go into business competing with them to serve the same people using your modified version of their code. One ethical position is you should be required to give your changes back to the world. You're competing with others in the public provision of services based on that code, and you should return to commons your modifications the same as if you were selling or distributing. That's one ethical point of view. The other ethical point of view is that this is a uniquely distinctive situation in which any attempt to interfere with the right to keep those subsequent modifications private interferes with the right of private execution and private modification, rights that ought not to be tampered with. Those ethical points of view are both very strong. There is no benefit whatever to the license maker or to the free software world in general in choosing between those ethical theories for everybody else. If we came to you and we said, we've thought about this hard ethical issue, there are absolutely good and absolutely clear arguments on both sides, they are of equal weight and importance, this decision will have billions of dollars affecting the world, we've decided it this way, A way or B, people would rightly say, what had you in your world that justified you in making that decision for everybody else? We will not make that decision for everybody. Nor will we make parties who want to adopt either ethical theory forego all use of existing GPL code. Imagine for a moment that we took out of Section 7 the portion that relates to the so-called Affero GPL clause. We dropped it from the license. Now, anybody who wanted to could make a new license containing that provision, but it would be GPL incompatible, and they could not use any of the world's existing GPL programs as a basis for building them. That would inevitably harm innovation because it would deprive people of all this shareable software. On the other hand, if we decided that every GPL included the Affero clause, there would, as you point out, be an awful lot of businesses in the world that would lose their right to use GPL code because for reasons that they consider good and sufficient for themselves, they do not wish to make their private modifications which convey business advantages to them in public-facing systems open to everybody else. They want to keep some source code that they have modified, even though they are using that source code to relate to the public. Very well, we say, we will simply allow an additional requirement to be placed on some code. If you build an Affero GPL model system, that is one which implements services over a network, deals with the public over that network, and in which any competitor who wants to use your code to build similar services must release their modifications, The best way of doing that is to build your whole application under GPL, take the part which does remote network services, which may be just one among many modes or models of interaction for that program, put that piece under a Affero GPL, or add the requirement, is how we would say it, and add to that program a feature which allows the user to download the server-side source. Once you have taken all those steps, your application can be made of any GPL parts, yours or other people's. The particular part that you wrote that communicates with the user over a network bears some additional requirements. Anybody who wants to take the whole rest of your application can do so and use it in any way they want, including private modifications and public uses. And if they don't like the part that you wrote being under a Affero GPL, they can rewrite it from scratch, thus minimizing the amount of re-implementation necessary in order to take your application, which was Afferoized, and de-Afferoize it so it can be used for private services. After lengthy analysis, we have concluded that this results in the optimal level of overall innovation and the minimum level of required re-implementation, so that every developer can get the result that every developer or that developer's business wants to get. I do not think that there is another solution available which reduces the amount of required re-implementation or which increases the net total of innovation. Therefore, I think this is the right system to apply.
But we take a very firm attitude toward DRM, right? And I think from a user's view, if we can use service, and can get results, but not can get results, but we can see source code, it should be called proprietary, and it may infringe our freedom of the third freedom, I think, to help community or something. So. I'm too dogmatic, but
I don't understand how you are losing any rights. If you write the thing yourself, nobody else's code's involved, and you can make any rules you want. If you use other people's GPL code to make an application with, how does it harm your rights to say you have to respect your users at the same level that they respected you as a user when they gave you the code? We're not in the business of preventing anybody from doing anything he wants with stuff he writes himself. The question is, if you get stuff from somebody else, which constitutes an entire application for public-facing services, and if he has written his application so that he wants mods released back into Commons, why should you think that you have a right to deprive him of that and still use his code? My notion would be, if you want to re-implement the part of his code which uses network services and leave the whole rest of it in place, you get a great deal of benefit. You get to use 90% of his code. He gets a benefit. You are required to respect users' rights for that 90% to the same extent he respected users' rights. If he respected users' rights a little more in the remaining 10% than you wanted to respect them, you have a choice. Swallow hard and take his approach to your users, or throw away that piece of his code and re-implement it. That's the minimum size re-implementation for you to have the same absolute freedom that you want to have. I don't think you're disadvantaged. I think you're advantaged to the extent of the continued shareability of code between two fundamentally different ethical positions.
So if it's okay, I'd like to ask a second question about translation. You said the translation is second best, and I think I agree more or less, but I'm from Japan, and most of people, even who can use English, prefer to read the Japanese translation of the licenses. And I understand the idea of official translation would be very dangerous, but I think it would be a good idea to make, how can I say, quasi-official translation, which means it's reviewed by several local lawyers. I mean, Japanese lawyers for Japanese translation, Spanish lawyers for Spanish translation, and at least FSF knew it. It was reviewed. How do you have?
I have two things to say about that. The first is that, as Mr. Stoneman indicated today, the question of translation is open for discussion, and I am listening to everybody about it. The second thing I want to say is that I made a trip to Tokyo before the beginning of the GPL3 process to meet with members of NEEC and METI, and to meet with lawyers from all of the major industrial organizations using GPL in Japan. They were all very gracious with their time. I said, we're going to make GPL3. We badly need Japanese lawyers who understand this business and its concerns to help us think about every single word in the GPL from a Japanese legal perspective. I want to work with the best Japanese lawyers you all identify to make this a better license. They all said, thank you very much, we'd be delighted to do that, and they did nothing. And the reason they did nothing was they did not want to expose their lawyers for non-privileged conversation on these questions. The result is that 12 months after that meeting, which occurred in June of 2005 in Japan, I have so far had zero meaningful legal assistance from the lawyers working for large Japanese industry. If it's important, it's important. If it's important later, it's important now. If it would be good for having to have them make an official translation later, then it would be good to have the same lawyers involved right now helping us to make a better license. Every single large industrial organization in Japan has highly talented lawyers thinking hard about these questions, and they speak English quite well, as I know from having done business with them for years. The problem we are having is not a language problem. The problem we are having is not a willingness to listen problem. The problem we are having is not a we don't care about Japan problem. The problem we are having is that parties have decided to wait and keep silent too long. I wish they wouldn't. I think the most useful contribution you could make would be to put heat on the organizations to bring their people in and start negotiating. It's now more than ready to start happening. We're halfway through the process. If my good friends in Japan wait until the 11th hour plus 30 minutes to come and tell us what they think and what they want, they're going to be disappointed. Not because I'm not going to listen, but because the train will have left the station. Please help them to get aboard.
Okay, that's what I'm doing now, but I should agree. Okay.
Right. I mean, right. And I'm responding to the suggestion that the way we should let them participate now is by letting them translate it when it's over. And I have said, gee, that's too bad. That's not a good way. Let's do it now.
All right. Thank you very much.
Nobody has any more questions?
You opened and closed your talk talking about Microsoft's capitulation. As someone who has constantly to deal with Microsoft meddling with governments and blocking initiatives by sheer amount of money power and stuff like that, I am more than keen to believe that it's that it is such, and it would be really very, very a great help for us not have to constantly fight that. However, from being exposed to that kind of thing too often, I am not very inclined to be so optimistic as to it going to stop anytime soon. What should we be looking for in the near future as further indications of this capitulation actually being effective?
Well, there used to be a Microsoft executive who was the executive vice president for platform technology, whose primary task was to beat winners, as they described it. His name was Martin Taylor. And everywhere he went, Martin Taylor was a very important
of pressure and interaction that you so well described. After the second great Longhorn reset, the one this year when this would only be a little late, Mr. Taylor was moved to work on Windows Live, where he became the dominant executive. Earlier this week, suddenly, without any pre-announcement of any kind, Microsoft fired. Mr. Taylor has worked at Microsoft since the age of 23. He's now 36. He was personally a pet of Mr. Palmer's. He has a great deal of Microsoft stock and no job. I don't know whether you would consider that a strong wind or not. I would say this. One of the reasons I wanted to do this work now, one of the reasons we identified when we started to pick this year to do GPL3, was that I believed that Microsoft would be busy doing something else. Their position in our process, their power to disrupt, was a significant concern to me from the beginning. When a company is trying to ship a major product of its own, of a kind that demands months and months of careful marketing and preparation, PR, as well as merchandise, it is not likely that they will spend a lot of money saying aggressive bad things about the third party. It's not known to be a good way to get your own product to market to spend a lot of time bad mouthing. So I thought this would be the best possible year to do this work, simply because Longhorn now Vista had to be released this year. I now believe that it runs a little deeper than that. The charm offensive Microsoft is currently conducting, which is palpable to any of us who work in this part of the world. The charm offensive Microsoft is conducting is now edgier than it used to be. There are fewer alternate options. Of course I don't want anybody to come off alert. I'm a lawyer around here. My job is anticipating war and being ready to fight it whenever it turns up. We have by no means stopped worrying about aggression. When Samba 4 is released, Microsoft will have the best reason for aggression it has had in a long time, because it will be competing against something that doesn't just ruin the server business for them, it eliminates the server business from them. The consequences are not going to be small for a company which already has nothing to offer on the server side, and which has never successfully sold the client side of anything to global enterprise without a server side to go. That's why the current situation is so dire in business terms for Microsoft. That means that they will be, when they act aggressively, if they act aggressively, acting aggressively for much greater reaches than they had in the past. Moreover, thanks to Carlo and others in this room and around this room, Microsoft is far more constrained by the European Commission antitrust proceedings than Microsoft was ever restrained by any antitrust proceedings anywhere else in the world. For the first time, the company faces the possibility of significant alterations to its behavior mandated within the lifetime of one of its products. And this, a product they are not going to be able to sell to knowledgeable consumers, is also in the pipeline at just the moment when it can be decisively affected by regulatory orders from the European Commission. And Carlo and our colleagues in that litigation have already shown that they know exactly how to testify, exactly what to ask for, and exactly to hold on to the anchor without letting go. I'm not here to tell you that this is going to be easy or simple, or that the U.S. Embassy is never going to be asked again to do a favor for Microsoft in some country in the world where the U.S. Embassy's word is terribly important. All of those things may very well happen. Our general ability to return fire is superior to at any time in the past. Our ability to do real strategic damage to their earning capacity is stronger than at any time in the past. Our allies more firmly believe in the possibility of beating them than at any time in the past. And in Google, they face an adversary of whom they are terrified. Google is, from our point of view, just a large user of our stuff. But from their point of view, Google is the business that terrifies them. And therefore, they are now dividing their anxiety again for the first time in years. After Mr. Gates figured out that we were the problem, we were for a long period of time his primary anxiety. Now, it doesn't matter what makes him anxious in the middle of the night.
night, he's just a philanthropist. As to Mr. Ballmer, what makes him anxious in the middle of the night? Lots of things make Mr. Ballmer anxious in the middle of the night. We're going to keep pumping up his blood pressure until maximum is reached very soon.
This is a very basic legal question. I'm not a lawyer. I'm just maybe a regular reader.
Yes, I'm not a lawyer.
Okay. I'm not a regular reader of Debian legal, which may be a bad thing. But I'd like you to comment, as regards to the GPL version 3, on what's called in Debian the dictator test, or the test that regards something that is not distribution or dissemination. As would be, for instance, the patent retaliation clauses. I don't completely understand about how these things can be free, which are really restrictions on freedoms that the person would normally have and do not affect pure redistribution. One is patent retaliation, the freedom to sue is one that one has, supposedly, and the other one is the affero type of thing, affero effects use, or liberty, freedom, zero. Not distribution or dissemination, which would be freedom one, as far as I understand. Maybe you could comment on that, and why the GPLv3 takes the views that it takes on those two issues.
Well, look, there are two aspects of that question, one of which I think is, as you say, sort of a Debian legal way of life. I try not to interact with the Debian legal way of life. But having just said I'm not a lawyer in this country, I suppose there's a reason that in this country I might interact with the legal way of being a little more. I'll try and pretend that I don't know anything about law anywhere in the world, and then I'll try and take that legal way of stuff. It generally turns out, as I know from having spent almost a quarter of a century now as lawyers for hackers, that when hackers pretend to be lawyers, there are certain predictable formulations that they come to. They assume a degree of consistency in legal rules which is not achievable. This is a primary problem which occurs particularly in U.S.-focused conversation, such as that in Debian Legal, where the libertarian demand for intellectual consistency and the hacker belief that law is a form of code that ought to execute without errors or ambiguities joins together to create a particular frame of analysis for legal questions. It doesn't work very well for me as a lawyer. I think it doesn't work very well for lawyers elsewhere in the world. Because the one thing which lawyers around the world all share is an awareness of the squishiness of law. It is by no means the hard arthropod carapace or internal soft ordinance that non-lawyers have a tendency to assume it is. With that in mind, the problem of the patent retaliation clauses is not a problem in the GPL for Debian or anybody else. If the Debian legal group had decided that the Apache software license was a non-free license because it had a defensive patent retaliation clause in it some years ago, maybe the Apache tribe would have decided not to put such a clause in its license. We are merely saying we're prepared to coexist with it. And since the Apache license is already a free license from Debian's point of view, I fail to see how coexisting with what's already free could be a freedom problem. So far as the Apache GPL clause is concerned, remember that what it says is, if you get a GPL program that has a facility in it giving server-side source code to the user, that's not a removable facility. That's the same statement that the GPL makes about interactive display of copyright notes. Lots of licenses in the world, rated free, say if the program displays a copyright notice when it starts running in the form you get it, then you have to leave that there. And the reason is for security of attribution, right? So here is another non-removable element in a free program, placed there out of a desire to protect people's freedom. I don't know how the Debian legal world will think about that. I know how the Free Software Foundation will think about that. The Free Software Foundation will say the very fundament of copyleft is a desire to limit freedom minimally in order to protect freedom in the long run. The question to be asked within the Free Software Foundation's ethics of law is not, is this a restriction on freedom, which is what I think I heard the Debbie and Eagle analysis doing. The question is, if this is a restriction on freedom, is it the narrowest possible restriction to protect freedom in the long run? Or is there a narrower way to accomplish the same protection of freedom? Or is it better to allow freedom to be defeated in the long run than to impose this restriction now? But it is always, I think, in Free Software Foundation thought, it is certainly characteristic of Mr. Stallman's thought throughout his career, it is characteristic, I think, to be minimalist about restriction, not negative about restriction. The position being taken is to have a community requires some minimal restrictions to preserve community. We tend to see the other side's view of that question. There ought to be no restrictions except those which are inevitable, as too libertarian to be firmly communal. If you want to keep a community in being, you may have to say, clean up after your dog on the sidewalk. Yeah, it's a restriction on use, but it's an alternative to having a lot of dog shit on the sidewalk.
Hi. Just a small speculation. You said that license is a unilateral permission. Why is that so hard for most law professors to understand? I mean, I agree with it, but I just don't understand why very few would like to argue in that direction.
Because in the course of the 20th century, post-Edison, the copyright license became a device for getting more out of the customer than copyright allowed. Once the Edisonian model of culture and distribution had come to be second nature, very few publishing parties wanted only what copyright gave them for multimedia or technically sophisticated works. They wanted more than copyright could give them, so they entered into contracts with their customers, one part of which was the license, and another part of which was additional obligations that they wanted users and customers to have. So over the course of decades, a copyright license ceased to be only a license and became very largely a contract for customers' obligations, because the customers' obligations were a big part of what the party writing the license, which wasn't the customer, wanted to see in there. We came along and said, we don't even want all of what copyright gives us, let alone do we want anything else. So we can use a pure license, because most of what we want to do is give away copyright law. And no part of what we want to do is to take additional obligations from people that aren't within the scope of copyright law. Therefore, for the first time in decades, somebody was building a business model around a pure license. And a whole bunch of lawyers who grew up in the world after Edison and before Stallman said, we've never seen one of those. Every license must be a contract because every license involves obligations by the licensee. And we said, that's new. That's normal. That's crap. Users have rights. You shouldn't take people's rights away from them using contracts where what you're giving them is just a program to run. It's in the nature of the criticism we were making of the legal institutions being used by others that we were calling attention to a thing which had happened barely consciously and which is still a kind of unreleased restriction in some people's minds. All right, thank you very much.